If not, at some other time, I'm sure some of you have stood in the historic old church in Richmond, where long ago Patrick Henry fired a verbal shot that was heard around the world. March 20th, 1775. A rare moment in time when centuries were crowded into hours. That speech was so phenomenal that one man who heard it, who was present there, expressed the desire to be buried on that spot when he died, and that wish was granted. Patrick Henry cut the knot that cautious souls had been trying to untie. They had been trying to work things out to a compromise with George III, but this red-headed Virginian was fed up with finagling, and he saw no sense in any further negotiations. He said, "I don't know what you're going to do, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. I especially want to emphasize what isn't usually emphasized, but as for me." The die was cast and the Rubicon was crossed and all the bridges were burned and retreat was impossible. There wasn't any uncertainty about where Patrick Henry stood. He cleared the air and stated the issue. No third dimension, no middle ground. A speech like that's awfully out of date now in a fuzzy day of woolly thinking, when we have experts in double talk who specialize in the art of almost saying something with a straightforward way of dodging the issue. Nobody coached Patrick Henry on how to mix black and white into an indefinite gray. His yea was yea and his nay was nay. And while contemporaries were going around their elbows to get to their thumbs, he believed that a straight line was the shortest distance between two points. His speech must have shocked some people, the school of caution, I'm sure. But it detonated that charge that blasted tyranny from our shores. Then another man said about the same thing. In Joshua 24, we go back to that great day when that great leader, they'd come through to the promised land through many dangers, toils, and snares. They'd already come. But he faced a vacillating, irresolute, hesitating multitude, easily swayed this way and that. One day singing the praises of God, and the next day dancing around the golden calf. It was an hour of decision, and he gave a resume, we won't read it all, of how God had led them to this good hour. And after all that rundown of the divine blessing in verse 14, he reached the climax. "Choose ye this day whom ye will serve, but as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord." Now, if there ever was a weak, neat generation swayed by the world, the flesh, and the devil, we're living in it today. And if there ever was a time when we need fathers like Joshua who will say, "As for me and my house, whatever the neighbors on the block do, where I live, whatever society may do, whatever the trend may be, whatever the fashion of the in crowd, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." It never has been so difficult as now when the law of God is disregarded and standards of decency and morality have gone into the wastebasket and our homes have cracked up until all the way from Maine to California it's a disaster area. Home-wise, the discipline's a forgotten word. And any man who takes a stand like Joshua is puritanical and Victorian and an out-of-date square. I'm dumbfounded at the way a lot of parents today who used to stand with Joshua or who knew to stand with him in the way they were brought up have surrendered to this age and invented all kinds of excuses to rationalize their defeat and the behavior of their children. But I also know some parents and some families who are still saying, "As for us, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord," and they're making a go of it in spite of hell and the devil. Now, if it ought to be done, it can be done. Jacob did it at Shechem, and Joshua did it at Shechem, both at Shechem. Shechem, back to Bethel, was the note of Jacob, and he said, we're going. They didn't take a vote. They didn't go over it all with the family to find out who wanted to go and who didn't. They weren't afraid they'd frustrate Junior. He just announced that we're going. And the terror of the Lord accompanied them, and the best way to build a ring of fire around the family is to do it this way. As for me and my house, or serve the Lord. We're all at Shechem today. And the way back to Bethel is the way that they took. But there's a third man, and I'm particularly concerned with him. Paul was writing to a young preacher, and in 1st and 2nd Timothy, he deals with three perils of the preacher and perils of any Christian. And the first one is the peril of things in the 6th chapter of 1st Timothy. Beginning at verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. That is an unfailing recipe for prosperity. Godliness plus contentment equals prosperity. Now, if you want to be rich, get rich. That's the way. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out, and having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some... And did you ever try for the moment just slipping in there the name of certain characters in the Bible? Balaam, for instance. Gehazi. Which, while Balaam, Gehazi, and many others erred from the faith when they coveted after it and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Now comes the word, but that. Now, the Revised Standard Version has it, but as for you, and I like that better. But as for you, you can't do like that. O man of God, flee these things. Every day is dollar day now in this country. William Jennings Bryan said the trouble with people who live for money is they spend the first half of their lives trying to get everything they can from everybody else, and last half, trying to keep everybody else from getting what they've got away from them. They don't find any pleasure in either half. Somebody asked John D. Rockefeller, how much money will it take to satisfy a man? And he answered, just a little more. Men live for money and what it'll buy. You say, well, it's the love of money. Yes, I know, but if you didn't have the money, you wouldn't have the love of money. So don't try to give it a good name on account of the way it's worded there. But as for me, I will not make things the god of my life, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. I heard about a hillbilly walking down the street in a small town some time ago by a furrier's shop. And they had a leopard skin coat there, a beautiful thing. And he looked at it a little bit and said, that old cat was better off before he was worth so much. I think I've known some cats like that. What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the world or lose his own soul? A Christian in a Cadillac's no more precious in the sight of God than a saint in a Jeep. That's not the yardstick. But life's poorest investment is to gain the world and lose your soul. God doesn't want any man to be any richer than his soul. I don't know how rich your soul is this morning, but that's his standard. And in these days, when we spend health looking for wealth and then turn around and spend wealth looking for health, we need to remember the good word, I wish in all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health. That's God's standard for health, too, as thy soul prospers. Then the second peril had to do with the times. And, of course, that's in 2 Timothy 3, where we have that formidable list of the characteristics of the last days. In the last days, perilous times shall come. For men should be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God. Reads like the morning paper, doesn't it? Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. And then he goes on with this description, but look down in verse 10, but thou hast fully known me, and then in verse 14, but as for you, continue in the things which thou hast heard. Now, a man would have to be blind in both eyes and bereft of his brains not to see this on the page of every paper every morning. Paul paints no rosy picture of the future. He doesn't foresee a converted world, neither did our Lord. He talked about abounding lawlessness and abating love. When the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth, as it was in the days of Noah? Well, how was it? You know how it was. The Cainitic civilization in Genesis 4 had produced cities and arts and manufacturing and advancement and culture. Then came the unholy mixture in Genesis 6, the sons of God and the daughters of men. And whatever that may mean to you as a Bible student, it's always a perilous thing when you mix what God never mixed and separated what God never separated. Wickedness abounded, the carcass and the vultures. Ignorance, and they knew not. It was educated, but the worst ignorance in this world is educated ignorance. And as it was, this is an old record that's been played a great many times, as it was, so shall it be. And those intellectual giants were soon clinging to the wreckage of a drowned world. And today, we've almost learned the secret of life. We've got a machine on Mars and hope to send a man over there. But when all these wonderful things happen, remember that when men say peace and safety, we never had less of it than we have today. God's going to intervene one of these days and come down with his bunch of keys and say, you boys have had it long enough. I'm going to take over. Paul Harvey says, Christians believe that Jesus Christ is going to intervene and take over down here when we have made a hopeless mess of self-government. Well, then he ought to be back any time. Now, in the midst of all this, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. God's not out saving civilization. Civilization is not going to be saved. God's taking out a people for his name. Noah had the fear of God. He prepared an ark. He preached repentance. He got the family in the ark. He was on the right side of that door when God shut it. And that's all that matters. Now, that's the picture of the times. And here in 2 Timothy 3, there was ignorance. But Paul says, but as for you, you know. And we ought to be like the children of Issachar, who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Old Josh Billings said, I'd rather know a few things for certain than be sure of a lot of things that ain't so. We've come to a day when people are chasing 1,001 things that aren't true and missing the thing that is for certain. So Paul goes on to say here, in such a day you know what time it is. Verse 1, perilous times, not prosperous times, not propitious times, perilous times. And then he said, you know me. You know how I have lived. You've had the example. Thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, and so on. Thou hast known me, and we've had the example of godly forefathers, not only Paul, but all men of God who have passed on the torch and kept the charge. Then he said, you know something else. You know how you were brought up. Continue in the things thou hast learned and hast been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them. Godly parentage, I thank God for it. Many of you do. Old-fashioned family altar before the day of women's lib and the total woman. And then you know about the Scriptures. From a child thou hast known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus. We know. We have no business getting into a mess in a time like this. But the schools turn out people with loads of learned lumber in their head but don't know how to build anything out of it. And we're taught to doubt the Bible today as though the height of ignorance were not to be sure of anything. Oh, they say the Bible is a sufficient rule of faith and practice, but I wonder sometimes if they mean all of it. If they mean all even of the New Testament. You've read of the bed of Procrustes. It was a peculiar bed. If a fellow was too short, they stretched him till he would fit it. And if he was too long, they chopped him off until he would fit it. Some people make a bed of Procrustes out of the Bible. They stretch it out or lop it off to suit the Procrustean ideas of their own interpretation, judging the book, forgetting that the old book's going to judge us. It's either absolute or it's obsolete. It's one of the two. And there's nothing else like it. I don't think any finer thing was ever said along this line than what Dr. Phillips said. He said, when you start digging into that old book and exploring around, you will have the feeling of an electrician wiring an old house where the power has not been cut off. You'll get a shock. You'll get a charge. You'll get something if you go at it as you ought. And then perils concerning the truth. Paul said, look out for that, because the time is coming when they can't take it. Preach the word. Be instant, in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come, and we have arrived, beloved, when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts, shall they heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned into fables. But as for you, I want to warn you this morning, dear friends, keep this in the back of your mind. There are some things other folks may do, but if you're going to be God's man, God's woman, God's young person, but as for you, watching all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof in ministry. Watch it. Too many Christian experiences start out in their earlier days with heartburn, and then they end up with ear itch, wanting to be entertained and pleased by the sermon. Against this background, you have peril then concerning things and concerning the times and concerning the truth. And the preacher and any Christian ought to stand out in vivid contrast to all of this. You're supposed to be something different. Now, the big question is, how different should a preacher and how different should a Christian be? Everybody wants to be different, but we've never been more alike. It's a most monotonous monotony. There never has been a time when we're all about the same. And it is as though the highway signs have all been torn down. We're free to drive as we please. Family life is shambles. But we've wound up with a strange similarity. Young people talk about being different. Now, I have a better response from young people than I've ever had in all these 60-odd years of preaching. But I say to them, and many times when we get together and they ask questions, and of course, always the same questions, what's wrong with dancing and rock and 40 other things, and I say, now, wait a minute, you're already off on the wrong foot. You're asking, how much like this world can I be and still be a Christian? Why didn't you ask, how much like Jesus can I be and how little like this world? How near the precipice can I walk without going over? That's what it amounts to when you go at it that way. I live across the street from the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And I tramp that campus a great deal. I look at that generation in blue jeans, like the country kids used to wear when I grew up and was hoeing corn down in a creek bottom. But you could tell the boys from the girls. And I've wondered what some charming feminine sweetheart of the 20s would do if she met a hippie today, looking like Rip Van Winkle after his long nap. I wonder what the reaction would be. And preachers are not supposed, of course, to be that somber soul in dark attire like the movies portray. I never saw many of those preachers, even back in those early years. But they like to play it up like that. But at any rate, they did call him reverend. I don't approve of that, but it did indicate some sort of respect. Now we've gone to the other extreme, and we have the Madison Avenue go-getter and the backslapper type, talking, acting, looking like anybody else, laughing at all the civic club jokes, sipping 7-Up at the country club, and so scared somebody will think he's a preacher. Used to be an honor. I don't mean that a minister has to go around looking dour. And I remember long ago in Sunrise Bible Conference they used to have up in New York State, John Hess McComb was there on the program with me, a very fine and distinguished and dignified gentleman. And one morning I came down attired a little brighter than usual, a little more color. And he looked at me and said, "The prophet is wearing snappy sackcloth." Well, of course, he meant it in the best of humor, you know. But I'm afraid that the church today is working overtime trying to destroy the old image of the preacher. And we're erasing all distinctions between clergy and laity and making the preacher just one of the boys, just as run-of-the-mill as any John Doe in a carpool on Monday on the way to work. Now, the devil is out to smudge all this black and white in the gray. Dr. Jowett, who is a prince of preachers, said, "We are tempted to leave our noonday lights in our study to move among men with a dark lantern which we can manipulate to suit our company. We pay the tribute of smiles to the low business standards. We pay the tribute of laughter to the fashionable jest. We pay the tribute of easy tolerance to ambiguous pleasures. We soften everything to a comfortable acquiescence. We seek to be all things to all men. We run with the hare and hunt with the hounds. There's nothing distinctive about our character. We're wearing gray when we mix with the businessmen of the congregation, and we talk gray in conversation with them." Now, that was a great English preacher. I think he's absolutely correct in this delineation of our tragic weakness along this line. God didn't intend for the preacher to be one of the boys. He meant for him to be ahead of the boys. Paul said, "Follow me as I follow Christ." And if you're going to be the life of the party all week, you can't reprove and rebuke and exhort that crowd on Sunday with any effectiveness. "Oh, you say Jesus ate with publicans and sinners." Yes, that one's been overworked in the last 15 years. "When he came to announce the kingdom, first to the house of Israel, yes. But as he drew near the cross, he ate only with his own and appeared only to his own. And in the Acts of the Apostles, they ate together, the saints of the Lord." But the image of a preacher and of a Christian is not opposed. Sometimes they strike a pose, trying to act according to a dramatized version of themselves. But if you're what you ought to be, and if the minister's what a preacher should be, the image will take care of itself, and it'll be said of them what the Shunammite woman said of Elisha, "I perceive that this is a holy man of God, which passeth by us continually." Oh, I have prayed that when I have completed my trip through this mundane sphere, that might be the consensus. That isn't popularity. That's another thing altogether. We must watch, beloved, what I talked about 2 years ago here, trendism. There are certain things that are not bad in themselves, and there's no use raising a hullabaloo about them. They're not bad in themselves, but they're headed the wrong way. And anything that has a question mark after it in your life, always be careful to size it up and say, "Now, let's see, which way is this thing going, and where will I go if I go with it?" Meat offered to idols is just as good as any other meat. Wasn't anything wrong with that meat. Paul said, "I won't touch it," because of the context. Now, you watch the context. There was a day when Spurgeon could say, many would unite church and stage, cards and prayer, dancing and sacraments. If we are powerless to stem this torrent, we can at least warn men of its existence and entreat them to stay out of it. But who's warning anybody about that? And think of A.J. Gordon, that mighty man of God of Boston. The notion having grown up, he said that we must entertain men in order to win them to Christ. You know, the end justifies the means. Any kind of a show's all right if two or three folks come down the aisle. But the trouble is that the means determines the end. If you have an unworthy means, you have an unworthy end. Entertain men in order to win them, and so every invention for world-pleasing which human ingenuity can devise has been brought forward till the churches have been turned into playhouses, and there is hardly a carnal amusement that can be named from billiards to dancing which does not find a nesting place in the sanctuaries. My soul, so what would he say now? Remember, this is A.J. Gordon. And he said, if we don't watch, we're going to find this trouble. Is it then Phariseeism or pessimism that at the present, now listen, beloved, fearful rate of progress, the close of this decade, his decade, may see the Protestant church as completely assimilated to 19th century secularism as the Roman Catholic Church was assimilated to 4th century paganism. Now, that's the kind of thinking that doesn't come just instantly. A man has to pray a lot and think a lot to see through the conclusions like that, but I don't hear much about it today. And even Augustine, way back before A.J. Gordon, said when peace was made between the emperors and the church, in order to make the new church members, you know how it was. Constantine became a professing Christian. Everybody joined the church. It was the end thing. And so the church said, well, now we want these folks to feel at home, so we'll mix up the holidays and the holy days. And that's why Santa Claus got into Christmas and Easter eggs into Easter and all the rest of it down through the ages. And nobody's trying to change it now, and I'm not about to take that responsibility on in my later years. But I'm talking to you about trends. You have to do something about the little serpent before it becomes a boa constrictor. Nothing's more repulsive. Nothing ever was more repulsive to my Lord than religious play-acting and the Pharisees, who were experts at it, but they drew the severest condemnation. How we need today to remember that you can go through all the motions and be a whirling at heart. Because a whirling doesn't mean that you dance and play cards and smoke necessarily. That's whirlingness. Yes, indeed. But you cannot do that and be like a Pharisee who wouldn't even eat an egg that had been laid on the Sabbath. Talk about separation. And yet my Lord said the publicans and harlots will go to heaven before you. You tithe mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Theodore Roosevelt, who is just about my favorite president, said that as a young man he was brought to serious thinking by two lines from Browning about a young duke who was a poor descendant by then of a noble line that once had had money. But he still tried to act a part. And here are the two lines. All that the old dukes had been without knowing it, this duke would fain know he was without being it. Now, we have a lot of that. We're raising a big crop of that today. And there's no sadder sight on Judgment Day than a phony preacher or a phony Christian. I shudder when I remember that my Lord said at the Judgment Day, Matthew 7:22-23, there'll be preachers who said, we've prophesied, we've cast out demons, we've done wonderful work, only to be told, depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Do you mean to tell me that a man can be a good enough preacher to cast out demons and prophesy and do wonderful works and yet be a worker of iniquity? And so this same Paul wrote to this same Timothy and said, look out for three things, preacher. Doctrine, what you believe. We've come to a time, it doesn't matter much what people believe as long as everybody's in good humor. Said, watch it. And Gresham Machen pointed out so well that in Philippians, Paul was concerned about a sound message with an unsound motive, but he was concerned in Galatia with an unsound message, which was worse, no matter what the motive was. That's a rather upsetting conclusion you'll arrive at if you check that there. And you've got to be right, beloved. It isn't enough to be almost right about this old book. I heard of a girl who was getting married and some friend wanted to send her a greeting and all that sort of thing, you know, and wanted to send a Bible verse. So he sent 1 John 4:18, which is a very good verse. There's no fear in love. Perfect love casteth out fear. But Western Union got hold of it. And they sent John 4:18. Thou hast had 5 husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. So you can't be almost right. Now, Western Union was almost right, but that won't do. So he said, you want to watch your doctrine, you got to watch also your dynamics. Stir up the gift of God that's within you. And you've got to watch your discipline. And when a young preacher today says, yeah, do you have any word for me? I said, yes, the same word that Paul had to Timothy. Get straight on doctrine, dynamic, and discipline. And that'll take care of it. John the Baptist was a burning and a shining light. Some have a lot of heat and no light, and some have light and no heat. And I don't know which is worse, hot-headed ignorance or cold-hearted intellectualism. I'd rather try to cool off a fanatic than warm up a corpse. So get the combination. You need the doctrine that you may believe. You need the dynamic that you may burn. And you need the discipline that you may behave. That's the combination. I know that it's very unpopular to be different today. Paul was, but Demas wasn't, and so he gave way to the world. I'm going back week after next, the Lord willing, to a preacher's retreat in East Tennessee in the depths of the mountains and in the heights of the mountains, Camp Carson. Oh, that's a great place for preachers together. This will be my third trip, and I climbed one of those every morning before breakfast and looked over the view, and I remember the first time I tried it. I got up part way and there was a break in the woods. And the temptation was to call a halt and let it go at that. But something inside said, keep on climbing. My legs were wobbling. My heart was thumping. Something inside said, who do you think you are, a teenager? Have you forgotten you were born in 1901? But I made it. And when I reached the summit, I said, well, the difference is worth the distance. Because there broke out before me a panorama such as I never would have seen through that break in the woods farther down. I beg of you this morning, keep climbing, beloved. If there's a preacher here, a young preacher, a young person in Christian work, keep climbing. Some of your contemporaries will say, oh, get off your high horse and join the club and tell them, I can't do it, boys. Faith has caught the joyful sound, the song of saints on higher ground. I want to scale the utmost height and catch a gleam of glory bright. And anything else, as far as I'm concerned, is out of the question. Old Elisha was on his way to see Elijah go to heaven in a whirlwind. You see, they just don't do that every day. And he wanted to see that. And the theological seminary over there at Bethel and the one at Jericho, the students were all outside the room. And they said, do you know your master's going up today? Yes, he said, be still. He wasn't going to get upset by these theologues over there by the side of the road. Once in a while, some Elisha makes up his mind to see the horses and the chariots
and get the prophet's mantle. The high soul walks the high road, and the low soul walks the low. And in between on the misty flats, the rest drift to and fro. If you're going to be different, it won't be easy. It may mean getting up early, earlier, to be still. Oh, William Law, that great man of God, said, "Who am I to lie folded up in the bed late of a morning when the farmers have already gone about their work and I'm so far behind with my sanctification?" Now, I think we'd all agree here this morning that whatever else may be true, we're all behind with our sanctification. It may mean for a minister skipping some little church meetings of the sons and daughters of I Will Arise that don't have anything to do with redemption anyhow. The road's long and the climb is steep, but if you make it, beloved, the difference is worth the distance. You may end up with not much to show for it of this world's goods, but you know what I said earlier this week. Pays low down here, but the retirement benefits are out of this world. You'll be like that Indian whose chief called him in along with his companions and said, "I want you to climb yonder's mountain." You may not make it, but if you must stop, pick up something wherever you stop, bring it back, show me that you got that far. And away they went. And he said, if you reach the top, you will see in the far distance the shining sea. And they went, and about the middle of the afternoon, one came back with a sprig of pine in his hand. He said, I could only make it that far. And another came back with a bit of fir, and another with a bit of spruce, and said, I got pretty well up, but couldn't do it. And then, late in the evening, the last one came back with nothing. And the chief was indignant. Said, what do you mean, coming back with nothing in your hand? He said, where I stood, there was nothing to bring back in the hand. But I saw the sea. Now, you think that one over. Live so that if you don't have much to show for it down here. Well, neither did Paul. Stocks on his feet and bonds on his wrists. That's all the stocks and bonds he had. Bring me that old overcoat and those books. My arthritis and bursitis and neuritis is getting me here in this old damp dungeon. But he said, I'm waiting for my reward. It's been a hard climb, but it's worth it. Because the difference is worth the distance. I'd like to recommend to every Christian here that you make yourself a motto. I advised that the other day in a church, and the staff took me up on it. Only a strange thing happened. One of the staff wrote it out, but as for you, and put it on a little wooden stand, neatly done. But he didn't put it on his desk. He put it on the pastor's desk. I don't think that was appreciated very much. I want you to keep it on your own desk. And there'll come a time when things will tempt you. And there'll come a time when the trend of the times will tempt you. There'll come a time when you'll be tempted to water down the truth. But remember, you can't live like other folks. Set that where you can see it, but as for you, no. We're developing a weak-kneed generation today, even in evangelical Christianity. Altogether too many who are so easily swayed by the things and the times and away from the truth. Make up your mind, like Patrick Henry and like Joshua and like Timothy was bidden to do. I don't know what others will do, but as for me, I've had my orders. God bless you.